Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the inspiring story of how a community of Buddhists launched a defense of religious freedom in the United States during the Second World War, the escape routes that were used to bring people to safety during that same war, and the heroes who operated them in the shadows. A novel that deals with the horrors of the concentration camps and the repression of memory. How literature, television, drama and documentary, well, all have a role to play in historical commemorations. And finally, to end the show, we'll discuss the worst nurses' strike in Irish history and celebrate a century of service as we look at the work of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. But first, a story of faith and freedom in the Second World War. In the darkest hours of World War II, when Japanese Americans were stripped of their homes and imprisoned in camps, a community of Buddhists launched one of the most inspiring defenses of religious freedom in the history of the United States, insisting that they could be both Buddhist and American. The book is called American Sutra, A Story of Faith and Freedom in the Second World War. It's published in hardback by Harvard University Press and costs £21.95 sterling, so about €24. The author is Duncan Jukin Williams. And Duncan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's fascinating because normally when we talk about the internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War, we usually look at it in terms of race. But you explore it in terms of religion, and that gives us a completely different perspective.
Right. I think one of the ideas I tried to point out in the book was that both in terms of the initial roundup of individuals who were on the FBI's list of people to be picked up in case of war with Japan, and the mass incarceration that happened in spring of 1942, in both cases, religion or Buddhism played a major role in how and why the internment happened in the first place.
And Buddhists were seen as a particular security threat, and Buddhist priests were seen as a real danger.
That's right. As far back as 1938, Buddhist temples were under surveillance. The priests were put on these security lists that the Office of Naval Intelligence, Army G2, and the FBI put together. And they were, in fact, not only amongst the first, but the very first person picked up, even before the smoke had cleared at Pearl Harbor at 3 p.m. that day. The first person they picked up was a Buddhist priest who was the head minister of the main Buddhist temple in Honolulu.
And in the face of all of these pressures, it would be very easy for this to become a story of a harsh, brutal story. But instead, it becomes an inspiring story in the way they launched this defense of religious freedom.
Right. You know, we tend to think about religious freedom as, you know, the free exercise or the separation of church and state. But in this case, it's really a story about how religious freedom requires a certain kind of attitude towards pluralism, and that at least in the American version of religious freedom, the founders intended that religious freedom is afforded to every different kind of religious community, including in this case, trying to assert religious freedom in the most difficult of circumstances, being forcibly removed from one's home and behind barbed wire and surrounded by armed guards.
And you use an incredible array of sources for this book: oral histories, diaries and memoirs, government documents, that you've managed to bring together a range of different perspectives and to give this perspective.
Yes, I initially started the book. This is a book that actually took me 17 plus years to research, write and edit. But it began with the translation of a diary by a Buddhist priest in one of these camps. But as you just said, you know, to do history, you want to try to triangulate, as it were, different kinds of sources. So the first person perspectives, but also government documents and oral histories together with you know, a more reliable written accounts as well.
And this definitely ties into debates that are taking place today in the United States about immigration and about race and about religion. And you very often see politicians making references to these camps during the Second World War.
That's right. Just very recently in the United States, there's been some particular conversation around the use of the term concentration camp. One of the rising stars in the Democratic Party used them to refer to some of the camps on the southern border that are housing unaccompanied migrant children. But these issues around race on the southern border and religion in terms of the so-called Muslim travel ban, these, unfortunately, these issues of who is included and excluded, and both in terms of immigration as well as internally within the United States, these are issues that unfortunately was, at the fore back in World War II, but seem to be coming to the fore today as well.
And Duncan, a final question. What do you think was it that was so inspiring about the stand they took? Did it lead to a new kind of American Buddhism?
That's right. You know, in a way, the fact that they, in the midst of all of these pressures to assimilate towards, sometimes I call it Anglo-Protestantism, that Anglo both in the sense of whiteness, but also in terms of the English language, and then Protestantism. This is something that immigrants from different, you know, places, Italian Catholics and German Jews, like different communities have had to overcome over time. But for people who are Buddhist, who can't find any common ground, let's say, with the Abrahamic faith, it was an even greater challenge, especially in the midst of war, especially in these internment camps. And so that's why, for me, this is a great example of people who made that example of this idea that it's possible to be Buddhist and American at the same time, who then inspire a later generation of people in the 1960s and 70s. And today, you know, you have Oprah interviewing Thich Nhat Hanh, you have Dalai Lama everywhere, you have mindfulness at Google. These are not, Buddhism today is so much a part of America's religious and cultural landscape, but it was not always so, and it took the embodied way of living Buddhism of these people back in World War II to, you know, create the case or create an example of how it is possible for one to have an American Buddhism at all.
Okay, well, Duncan, congratulations on the book. It's called American Sutra, A Story of Faith and Freedom in the Second World War, published in hardback by Harvard University Press, costs about €24. The author, Duncan Jukin Williams. And Duncan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book focuses on extraordinary examples of heroism during the Second World War away from the battlefield. It specifically considers the actions of individuals in various Allied escape lines set up to help those on the run. And the book provides the most complete picture of how these routes operated, the qualities of the people involved, their courage, and how they held out against all kinds of adversity. The book is called Heroes in the Shadows, Humanitarian Action and Courage in the Second World War. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. And the author is Dr. Brian Fleming. Brian, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
Can we begin with this extraordinary individual called Pat O'Leary, who I assumed was going to be an heroic Irishman, but was actually an heroic Belgian doctor?
Yes, I'm not sure why he adopted the name Pat O'Leary. It does sound very Irish, but his real name was Albert Marie Garice, if I have the pronunciation correctly. And he ended up performing great work in the southern part of France, particularly during the war.
Yeah, so tell me about the way this book is constructed. Because tell me about these escape lines, how they assisted people on their own, who they assisted, and how they operated. What was going on here?
There were two sort of escape lines. One was looking after Jews particularly and other people who were fleeing because of their political views. And had good reason to avoid the Nazis' encroachment into France. The other lines then were looking after Allied servicemen. About 50,000 Allied servicemen, British particularly, didn't make it from Dunkirk. They either didn't get off the beach or they didn't arrive in Dunkirk in time before the option of getting off was closed off. So these 50,000 were in France. Some were captured around Dunkirk, but many of them escaped subsequently. And their duty, of course, and their anxiety was to get back home as quick as they could and rejoin their regiments. So the other set of escape lines was looking after these people, trying to get them back to Britain and back into the war. And as the war went on, then there were others who had to jump out of planes and so on, parachute out of planes, or were shot down over various parts of Western Europe. And Britain was particularly anxious to get those back because, of course, pilots were scarce and took a bit of time to train. So that was the second set of escape lines.
And it's interesting to see the different types of people who are involved in these operations. And in some of the examples, you have heroic diplomats who defied their own authorities and defied the authorities in the countries they were based to help these people.
Yeah, that's the bit that surprised me. I mean, I wrote a book about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, on Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty. I think you know that. And he set up the Rome escape line. So when I was researching that book, I became aware of other escape lines. But quite frankly, I didn't know much about the diplomats. But there were diplomats in France, in Budapest, and in Vienna, and in Lithuania that I've come across. And there were probably a few others who sort of bent the rules or did what they could to get people to safety. Perhaps the most outstanding of those, I think the most outstanding anyway, was a Portuguese called Sousa Mendes, Aristides de Sousa Mendes. He was the consul general in Bordeaux when France collapsed and the Nazis were coming in towards Paris. And of course, Jews particularly and others began to flee south. And there was a huge movement of millions of people fleeing south. Some not particularly afraid of the Nazis, just wanted to get away from the conflict zone. But anyway, these people began to approach Sousa Mendes in Bordeaux for help. And in the initial stages, he was bending the rules a little bit. His authorities in Portugal, particularly the dictator Salazar, was keen that nobody would come through Portugal to safety. He didn't want to be seen to take sides on either side in the war. He just wanted to stay neutral, much like Franco in Spain. So he put in a regulation that if somebody like Sousa Mendes wanted to grant a visa to a refugee to reach Portugal or to travel through Portugal to some place like the US, he had to seek permission from the foreign ministry in Lisbon. Sousa Mendes began to bend the rules a little bit. He'd grant the visa and he'd look for permission afterwards, a sort of a Jesuit approach. And then when the numbers became too big, he just began to issue visas without any permission. Didn't last too long because obviously the authorities weren't going to put up with this. But he did issue thousands of visas in Bordeaux. As the Nazis progressed down through France, he moved to Bayonne. He issued more there. And even when he was at the border with Spain, he issued more in the village of Hendaye. All in all, he issued at least 10,000. Well, I should say, visas were often for parents as well as children. So at least 10,000 people benefited, and others would say maybe up to 20,000.
Extraordinary. Let's go back to Pat O'Leary and his escape line, because it became known as the Pat Line.
There was the makings of an escape line in Marseille when he arrived there in 1941, but it was a little bit disorganised. And O'Leary was obviously a fine leader of men, but he was organisationally very sound as well. And he established an escape line there where people, British servicemen moving south, which was the obvious thing for them to do, many of them made for Marseille as a port with the hope of getting away. Wasn't that easy because the Nazis had spies everywhere, even though it was in the free French zone. And he set up a line to bring these people across through Spain, down down to Gibraltar and thence home. And he operated that scheme right. He extended it way up into Paris and beyond. So he had a sort of a chain of supporters all the way down to get people to Marseille and then bring them across the Pyrenees into Spain. And he had help in Spain then to get them down through to Gibraltar. And of course, once they got to Gibraltar, they were able to go home.
Okay, it's an extraordinary story and you tell it so well in the book. The book is called Heroes in the Shadows, Humanitarian Action and Courage in the Second World War. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing and costs about €24. The author, Brian Fleming. And Brian, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Translated into English for the first time, the novel Deviation is about the repression of memory and one woman's attempts to make sense of the hell of the Nazi concentration camps. It's called Deviation. It's by Luce D'Armo. It's published in hardback by Pushkin Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. And the person who has brought it to our English speaking and English reading audience for the first time is Adam Freudenheim. And Adam, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you come across the novel Deviation? Because I think it was published, 40 years ago?
Yes, correct. It was first published in Italy in 1979 and was an absolute phenomenon there, becoming a bestseller. But it had never appeared in English before. It was translated into several other languages. But as often happens, of course, things don't necessarily make it immediately into English. And this is one of those examples. So I found out about it in a pretty standard way in my world, which is that the rights holder of the book, the sort of representative of Feltrinelli, the Italian publisher, who were publishing a new edition of it, about 5 years ago, got in touch with me because they realized that it had never been in English before and asked if I'd be interested. And so I had a couple of Italian readers look at it for me because I don't read Italian myself, and got detailed reports on it along with the American publisher who did the same. And we both decided to commission a translation. And that's how it happened. I mean, the story of it is extremely unusual, as I'm sure you've gathered from reading it, if not reading about it.
Yeah, tell us about it. It's about a passionate young fascist who ends up having her illusions shredded when she experiences the reality of what was going on in these camps. So tell us about, because it's in a way it's part novel, but it's also part memoir.
Yes, it's very much an autobiographical novel with the emphasis on autobiographical. And I think, you know, maybe it's being... Most memoirs, of course, are not all entirely nonfiction, too. If you think about the way that people have to create their, you know, their recreate the memories of the things that happened decades ago. So perhaps she was just more honest by calling it a novel. And I mean, someone like Karl Ove Knausgård now, he called his books a novel as well. But I think anyone who reads them in a way as nonfiction, too. But so she was her parents were fascists, and she was herself a young fascist as a teenager, joining the equivalent, I guess, of the Hitler Youth in Germany, the equivalent to Italy. And then at 18, she decided to, which is at this point, towards the very end of the war, and it was clear what direction things were going. But nonetheless, she decided to go into labor camps in Nazi Germany and to sort of see that what she thought was bad PR that the regime was getting, to kind of to prove that was the case. And of course, obviously, she discovered something else entirely. So that really attracted me to the book, because I just feel like, you know, we're endlessly fascinated by stories about the Second World War. I think that's just a fact. And I certainly am myself, but a lot of them are quite familiar. And this is a story I had never come across myself. And the fact that it was a true story, just added to it. I mean, it is absolutely fascinating. Though it should be emphasized that she didn't visit extermination camps in Poland or in other parts of Eastern Europe. She was at Dachau in Germany and other places, but they were not actually extermination camps, but labor camps, of course, where people were very badly treated, but they weren't being gassed.
Well, tell us about the descriptions that you had of Dachau, because it doesn't make for easy reading.
No. it's a difficult book to read, because I think that she, you know, what I think makes the book interesting in a way is the fact that she tells the story in a kind of, you know, she wrote the book over several decades. It was published in 79, as we've said, which was, you know, 34 years after the events that she's writing about. But she wrote the book in the 50s and in the 70s, you know, and she kept coming back to her memories, you know, and kind of trying to work through them. That's how I see the book. And obviously the things that she encountered there were, you know, were not at all what she imagined. And she herself was most kind of she was there towards the end of the war and was injured in an air raid and paralyzed from the waist down. In fact, she didn't think she would survive. So I think that's another backdrop to why she wrote the book the way she wrote it, in that she was, you know, she was paralyzed and had to go through many operations in order to live. And so I think that kind of affected her memory, and she had become addicted to medication, you know, to drugs in the process of that. So it's a very unusual story that she had. And so I think that's how she came to write the book in the way she did. I think it's an incredibly powerful, but it is a difficult book to read.
Was it controversial when it was published because it's maybe a part of history that some Italians may not want to revisit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's as we know, the Italy was allied with Nazi Germany. And of course, at the, you know, towards the end of the war, when they seemed to be, you know, losing their enthusiasm, you could say, for the cause, Germany effectively, you know, occupied Italy themselves, and then that's when they, you know, with the help of obviously fascists who remained in Italy, began to deport and Jews from Italy, and you know, it was, you know, it's not a good period of Italian history, and of course, you know, the fact that she is. The fact that she's from this fascist family herself, and kind of exposing, I guess, at first hand, though she doesn't really talk about her parents very much in the book, but she's sort of, you know, indirectly exposing it, I don't think came, you know, was very popular. But having said that, the book was extremely well received in Italy, on the whole, and sold very well, certainly, in the late 70s.
And what do you think we can learn by studying a book like Deviation? Because it has an exploration of trauma and memory, war guilt. But it's also, we have to recognize that some is memoir and some is fiction, and then we have to mediate between that. So there's a lot of levels to this.
Yeah, absolutely. But as I said earlier, I mean, I think that's true in lots of books, and we just don't necessarily, the authors aren't necessarily so upfront about it. So we don't focus on the fact that they're, you know, recreating memory. I mean, one of the most famous books about the war for a long time and still is Elie Wiesel's Night, which, you know, he wrote in the late 1950s. But he was writing about a period when he was a child, you know, quite a few years earlier. In all honesty, of course, we read it as autobiography, but naturally he's had to recreate scenes from, you know, 15, 20 years earlier when he was a very young person that, you know, there's got to be a level of fiction involved there. So, but to answer your more general question, I mean, I just think every testimony of any kind that we can read about this horrific period in history is important and interesting, and Deviation just adds another layer to it. And another aspect to the story, and makes us appreciate, you know, Italy's involvement, which I don't think is given enough attention by a lot of people. You know, we focus so much on Germany, and also just the kind of it's also interesting because it's not about the fact that it's not about extermination camps, but it's about you know, Dachau and other labor camps and just how badly people were treated there. And it's very vividly told and vividly written. I mean, I was, in the head of the interview, I was rereading bits of it, and I just was struck by what a good writer she is and how she captures characters and exchanges, you know, the conversations that she had with people in those camps. I think it's a very important book, Deviation. Really, really interesting and challenging, but important.
Well, the book is called Deviation. It's published in hardback by Pushkin Press. Costs 20 sterling, so about 24 euro. The author, Luce D'Armo, and Adam Freudenheim has joined me tonight to talk about Pushkin's Press translation of it. Adam, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back. A new book written during our decade of centenaries draws on the aims of the Sirach series to reimagine commemoration. It's called Commemoration, and it's part of the Sirach Longings for Another Ireland series. It's published in paperback by Cork University Press and costs €9.95. The author is Heather Laird. And Heather, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Tell us first of all about this series, Sirach, and what it means, this Longings for Another Ireland.
Okay, so I suppose it takes its inspiration from two sources. One of those would be an Irish kind of folklore source where we have this idea of a fairy lore, of a fairy world that lives kind of parallel to our own world. And that gives us the sense of another kind of world that is actually there underneath us, somewhere close beside us. And then connected with that is, I suppose, contemporary social movements and their idea of another world being possible and the need to create that world and to challenge orthodoxies, particularly, I suppose, in the present where our own world is facing such a kind of catastrophic, probably crisis in the future. So we need to imagine kind of new ways of being. So this is like an Irish version of that, I suppose. So we have the idea with the series is that you take a number of topics like money is one of the books so far, commemoration, freedom, the public sphere, and then you critique those but also reimagine them.
And one of the ways you approach commemoration is by I suppose, forcing us to confront the idea that the past could have been different than it was. It could have turned out in different ways, and that we also need to explore these roads that were not taken.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose as well as being inspired by the Sirach series, I'm also very much inspired by radical or critical historical frameworks. And I use those really to reimagine commemoration, because commemoration, very much like mainstream historiography, tends to focus on the events that are seen as having the most impact on what happens afterwards. So events seen as foundational to the development of a people, nation or state. And I suppose the issue with that is that it makes the present seem, or it can make the present seem inevitable, a kind of preordained destiny. And what I suggested in the book that instead, we think of every moment in time as a moment of possibility. There are always other roads that could have been taken, other paths that could have gone down. And I think from the vantage point of current orthodoxies, those roads may seem now as if they were destined to be cul-de-sacs. But I think the question is, we have to ask, well, were they really? Looking at, and I suppose to make it less abstract, if we think about the current decade of centenaries, we could think about things like challenges to private property and land usage. So let's say James Connolly's idea of Gaelic communism, or even the land seizures of the early 1920s and some of the experiments in collectivised farming that that followed those. Because I think we live in Ireland now in which we have a real sort of fetishization of private property, and that almost could seem inevitable. It could seem as if that's the only way Ireland could ever have turned out, to have this kind of, that there's some sort of property owning DNA in our system, that we're destined to be people who are obsessed with private property. But I think if we look back even at the decade that we're now commemorating, there are all these challenges to the primacy of private property that may have led us in other directions.
And when we approach things like the centenary of the treaty and the Civil War, which I think would be a very difficult thing to commemorate, do you think this approach could help us to explore it and remember it in a different way?
Well, it's interesting. I think I was very conscious this year in particular that we're approaching what's considered to be the sort of latter uncomfortable years of the decade of centenaries. And I could even sort of sense a kind of anxiety on the part of the state. How do we approach these years and the need to kind of recognise competing political visions? What I would hope is not lost in that is that there are also competing socioeconomic visions in the latter years of the decade that we're currently commemorating, and that they're not pushed to the side in this kind of need to maybe have sort of, you know, recognise competing political visions in the latter years of the decade of centenaries, and also just in terms of those competing political visions. What I would like is you know, we need to have this sort of complex story of those latter years of that decade. But that doesn't mean reducing everything to a kind of two-dimensional, bland version of itself. We can't be too relativist about this either. People aren't, I think sometimes we have a sense that people are less sophisticated than they are. People are capable of kind of making judgments about stuff. Historians shouldn't feel under pressure to sort of avoid offending anyone.
So looking back then to the commemoration of the 1916 Rising, the centenary of that, how do you think that was done then? Was there a sense that maybe it only focused on the road taken rather than the roads not taken, or did they get the balance right?
I suppose if I'm kind of thinking about the 19, I suppose one of the first things I'd say is that obviously the 1916 centenary was the big one of the decade of centenaries so far. And that does still reveal that overlap between commemoration and mainstream historiography, the narrow focus on the political. So let's say, you know, 1913, for example, 5 months of a lockout, you know, so many people involved. And there were events, but in some ways it felt like lip service in comparison to the 1916 commemorations. The 1916 commemorations themselves, I think there were a kind of interesting mix of what happened. I think actually probably what I liked most about it was the sense of all of the kind of small events that took place throughout the country, like people having some sort of investment in terms of our country and where it should be, and also people's attempt to kind of align it with their contemporary concerns. So reimagining Ireland today, the idea that 1916 was something about people having a vision for Ireland. And one of the things I liked about it was that you could see so many people now kind of going, well, actually, what is our vision for Ireland now? What have we failed to do right? What have we done right? Where could we go better in the future?
It's interesting the way you approach it, using not just history, but drawing in other things, literature and television, economics, politics, that it's very much going across so many different disciplines and areas.
Yeah, I think I just naturally do that because I would consider myself an Irish studies scholar, and I don't really think in terms of disciplinary boundaries because that's not how the world works. So the world doesn't work that way. And I mean, I suppose when I was writing about the centenary, the 1916, for example, I was interested in the docudrama at the time, Insurrection, because there had been so much controversy about that and whether that had been important in terms of the Troubles. But I was also interested in looking at that formally in comparison to, let's say, our contemporary centenary drama, Rebellion, and just comparing and contrasting those to see how they dealt with that period.
And finally, do you think that commemoration is a good thing for states to be involved in? Or is it a healthy thing for the public at large?
I think it's kind of unavoidable. So therefore, I think it because it's kind of unavoidable, then it's useful to talk about it, to think about what's left out of commemorations, why they're left out, why certain things become key. Also that overlap between history and commemoration, because so much focus is put on the kind of uneasy tension between history and commemoration, which a lot of historians quite, critical of commemoratory practices. I think it's just as interesting to look at where they overlap and what commemoration can tell us about history in general, because commemoration often does what a lot of mainstream history does, but in a more kind of overt way, focusing more on the narrowly political, focusing on that, which seems foundational, reading history backwards, essentially. So looking at what happened in the past that most obviously led to our current, circumstances.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book, and thanks a million for joining us in studio tonight to talk so passionately about commemoration. The book is called Commemoration, part of the Cirach Longings for Another Ireland series. It's published in paperback by Cork University Press and costs €9.95. The author, Heather Laird. And Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. In February 1919, 20 nurses and midwives meeting in Dublin to discuss their poor working conditions took an historic decision to establish a trade union, the first of its kind in the world. The Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation INMO, now numbers 40,000 and is Ireland's largest nurse and midwife representative association. And its story has now been told in a new book. It's called A Century of Service, A History of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. It's published in hardback by Irish Academic Press and costs €24.95. The author is Mark Lockery. And Mark, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
How do you do, Patrick? Thanks for having me.
Let's go back 100 years. Tell us about the establishment of the INMO in 1919.
So it was essentially established by 20 nurses and midwives who met in a small office at 29 South Ann Street on a cold February evening in February of that year. The reason they did so was because their working conditions were absolutely dreadful. So to put it in context for you, Patrick, in 1919, unskilled men at the Ford car factory in County Cork, they were bringing home £239 per year. In contrast, nurses at a Dublin hospital earned a maximum of £65 per year, and they also received an allowance of food. They earned 3/4 pound of butter, 1 stone of potatoes per week, as well as 1/2 pint of milk per day. And they were working a 65-hour week, and they were told that any sick leave or holidays they took had to be made up by working that time back. So what we seen at the time was agitation towards what was called a Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Nurses. And that's exactly how they described it in the journals of the day. And that's what the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation became.
In its middle years, it had a reputation for being conservative or somewhat conservative, but it became more militant in the 1970s and the 1980s.
That's right. I mean, if we go back to the organisation's early days, you could say it was a revolutionary organisation. In fact, it was the very first trade union for hospital nurses in the whole world. And the reason for that is because of the unique milieu or backdrop that was happening in Ireland at the time, what with the labour movement, with the first wave of the women's movement, and with nationalism and republicanism. So all of that kind of revolutionary ideal fed into the nurses' union. However, come the mid-1920s, you're right in saying that it did become a more conservative organisation. And I don't mean to carve out a picture of the INMO as a monolith of some kind. You know, really what it was a reflection of the kind of conservatism that swept over Irish society at the time. So it was merely just reflecting that.
Talk to me about the nurses' strike in 1999, because that has been described as one of the largest strikes in Irish history. And I think you can see from there the maybe the difficult, the complex relationship that nurses and midwives have with strike action.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extremely complex relationship between nurses, midwives and strike action. To really talk about the 1999 strike would be remiss without going back a couple of years. I mean, the genesis of that strike occurred in the early 1970s with the establishment of the Commission on the Status of Women. And the INMO was partly spearheaded that campaign. And what it recommended was two things in the main that were of distinct interest to nurses. Firstly, the abolition of the marriage bar, and secondly, equal pay between men and women. Why is the abolition of the marriage bar important? It's important because nursing and midwifery up to that point in time were very much stopgap jobs. They weren't seen really as careers by the vast corpus of nurses and midwives. So when the marriage bar met its demise, what we see here is a much more militant workforce emerging, because these were women who now were going to be in this career forever, not just until they found a husband as such. Secondly, equal pay was recommended by the Commission on the Status of Women. How did that affect militancy? It affected militancy because the state Welsh, they waxed and waned as best they could not to give in to equal pay for nurses. And what they argued was that there were so few men in nursing at the time that they couldn't really establish a male rate. So what happened was, just like a pressure cooker, the pressure began to build under the nurses. And from that point on, from the late 1970s in particular, they rescinded their no-strike policy, which had characterised the union since its early days. And 20 years later, things exploded with this strike, one of the largest strikes in Irish history, as you say. And what that strike was a strike of sorts. This was nurses and midwives' first outing on a militant footing, on a strike footing. And what they did was they devised a strike whereby they would perform all emergency and essential care, all for free, of course. They didn't get paid for any of it. And I sat down with a number of nurses who took part in that strike. And what we did was we conducted oral history interviews. And we went down the oral history route because, to me, stories are everything. You know, who would we be without our stories? Where would we be without our stories? And a number of nurses sat down with me and they told me the most interesting stories. You know, what they said to me was they were settling old scores, they were setting the record straight, they were doing any number of things through those stories. And stories are really everything because they keep us healthy and strong. They give us the wherewithal to go out into the world and do all of the other things that we had to do. And I not only interviewed the INMO's leaders, but I interviewed the INMO's regular members, ordinary working nurses and midwives just like me. And I have some of those stories here today if you'd like to hear them.
Definitely, because I think those oral histories give us a sense of not only the difficult working conditions, but the courage, the determination, the tenacity of these nurses and midwives.
Absolutely. So one of the nurses, one of the very first nurses who came for an interview, this is what she said to me. She worked in the area of oncology at the time, and she sat down with me one day, and after I pressed record on the tape recorder, this is what she said. She said, "I found it to be a very difficult time. I worked in the area of oncology and the agreement had been that nurses wouldn't give intravenous medications. I was assigned a patient who was very ill and who required intravenous medications. And this woman, I can still see her. She was only young. She was like 25 years old and she was miserable. I said, I am going to give her medicines. The patient was so incredibly grateful. She said to me she understood the nurses were in a difficult situation. And I met her about a year later shopping. She came over to me and she said, I will never forget what you did. Now, what was that worth? That was worth everything."
Very, very powerful. Mark, a final question. If the INMO hadn't been founded 100 years ago, what do you think would have, how would that affected the course of Ireland over that 100? What, in other words, what difference has it made?
I think nursing and midwifery would look and feel much, much different, and not for the better were it not for the foundation of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation all the way back 100 years ago. First of all, I don't think we would have university level education. That would be one of the enormous things in my eyes.
Very good. Okay, well, Mark, congratulations on the book and thank you so much for joining us tonight. A Century of Service, A History of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, 1919 to 2019. It's published in hardback by Irish Academic Press and costs €24.95. The author is Mark Lockery. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be looking at the life and legacy of Queen Victoria, and we'll be assessing the impact of the Victorian age. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night. Thank you.